then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's the 81st anniversary of the German Revolution, January the 30th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. 81 years ago tonight, on January the 30th, 1933, after 14 years of struggle, which included defeat, prison, and many deaths, Adolf Hitler became the Chancellor of the German Reich. The torchlight parades throughout Germany celebrated the beginning of a new era for all of our folk, a new era which still exists despite the disaster of 1945. Because of the revolution of 1933, we now have an example for all time of the historical truth that nothing is immutable, nothing is inevitable, nothing is engraved in stone forever. I can think of little to say on this date that has not been said before, or will not sound childishly naive, but nonetheless, I'll try to distill it all into a few sentences. There is hope, if we will but accept it. The filth and corruption and betrayal that was the Weimar regime fell. The New World Order of Barack Hussein Obama will fall as well. What we are trying to do was, in fact, done once before. It is not impossible. It is not beyond reach. It is doable. We know because Hitler did it. The German people did it. We have farther, much farther to go, and before we can achieve what the Führer achieved, we must recreate and reinvent and reforge our very souls in the white-hot furnace of racial struggle. But genetically, we are every bit as strong and as brave as those brown and black-clad Germanic heroes who trod the cobblestones of the fatherland 81 years ago tonight, beneath the light of 10 million torches. Now, people ask me a lot how I can stand the kind of treatment I get, how I can keep on going in the face of all the madness and the hatred and the revolting cowardly behavior of men with white skins, white faces, and the souls of rodents. I can keep going because those torches from that January night so long ago in my grandfather's world burn in my mind's eye and in my heart. I keep on going because I know that what we see from so-called white men today is an aberration, a corruption, the ultimate expression of Judaic cancer gnawing away at the Aryan soul before death. I keep on going because I know that those who shout and screech and revile on the internet like deranged monkeys are not the true representatives of my folk. And those men who marched beneath the torches under the January stars of Germany on that night so long ago are. It is they who fill my thoughts and my spirit, not these other critters. Now, sometimes we are so depressed and demoralized and angered and revolted by what we see today from so-called white people that we forget. All of this left-wing liberal lunacy is a very modern phenomenon, less than 100 years old, really. For thousands of years before that, our males were men and our females were women, not consumer organisms or politically correct duck speakers. And that for all their assault on everything good and decent, you can't sweep away millennia of culture and history and folkways in one or two generations. And despite it all, I sense a great awakening coming. Now, this is where I have a lot of trouble conveying to all of you my overwhelming sense of basic optimism about all this, however poorly justified that optimism may seem at times. Now, if I were not convinced utterly and completely that history is on our side and that our folk will survive and conquer, I certainly wouldn't waste my life sitting here being heckled and insulted by crybabies and federal agents while beating a dead horse. Long ago, I would have done like good Americans do. I would have quit when the job became too hard and tried to grab something for me. But I'm still here. That should tell you something. It's going to happen for us people. Now, it may not happen like we want it to happen. It may not happen like it happened in Germany or in my Northwest novels. In fact, it almost certainly won't. It will happen in some typical, sloppy, dysfunctional, half-insane, and utterly American way. That unique brand of shrill and hysterical brilliance encased in a turd, which is the hallmark of this country and its white people. Now, it took me a long time to understand and accept that myself. My longing to see the long brown columns marching beneath the torchlight is every bit as urgent and deep as anguished as most of yours is. But it will happen as the inscrutable forces of history dictate, in ways which are appropriate and natural to our time and our place. We, too, will have our flag raising at Longview, our January 30th someday. Right here in the Northwest, and when that day is over, these filthy, evil people and their black and brown pets will all be gone, and we will finally be able to live again. I know this. Don't ask me how. I could never explain it. I just know. Stay strong. Try to stay sane. Don't fall by the wayside. Be there with me, guys, when that glorious day comes. Now I want to speak specifically and individually about just one of those heroic men who managed to free an entire nation from the tyranny of communism and capitalism both. A man who lived and died not even 100 years ago, but in a time that now seems almost lost in the mists of the far past. It seems so distant from this sick and twisted world we live in today. Not the Fuhrer himself. Not Dr. Goebbels, or a man that anyone outside a few very, very old people in Germany would remember today, but a common soldier in a dirty, covert war who fought and died to bring his people and his land a new day. Horst Ludwig Wessel was a National Socialist hero during the Kampfzeit, the time of struggle from 1919 to the day of the German Revolution on January the 30th, 1933. He was the author of the lyrics to the song Die Fahne hoch, which means Raise the Banner, usually known as the Horst Wessel Lied, or Horst Wessel Song, which became the Nazi Party anthem, and which was also part of Germany's dual national anthem from 1933 to 1945, along with Deutschland über alles. Wessel was born on September the 9th, 1907, in Westphalia, the son of a Lutheran pastor named Dr. Ludwig Wessel, who, from 1913 until his death in 1933, was minister at one of Berlin's oldest churches. His mother also came from a family of Lutheran pastors. Although he was later portrayed by hostile liberal and Jewish sources as an illiterate thug, in fact, Wessel had a pretty good education and was of at least average intelligence. He attended primary school from 1914 to 1922 and the gymnasium, which is the secondary school, in Königstadt from 1922 on. He sat and he passed his Abitur, which is the German school leaving examination. In April 1926, he enrolled in the law faculty of Friedrichs Wilhelm University, which is now Humboldt University. And he appears to have been a satisfactory student until he decided to devote all of his time to the National Socialist Movement. Wessel was politically active from an early age. In December of 1926, at age 19, he joined the NSDAP and the SA, or Brown Shirts. Until that time, the Nazis had been very weak in Red Berlin. But from 1926, under the energetic leadership of the new Gauleiter, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the newly named quote-unquote Nazis rapidly displaced the other parties of the right. Wessel was one of the wave of new young recruits that Goebbels brought into the party. Wessel soon impressed Goebbels, and in January 1928, during the period when the Berlin city authorities had banned the SA in an effort to curb political street violence, he was sent on a study trip to Vienna to study organizational and tactical methods of the Nazi movement there. In May of 1929, Wessel was appointed leader of SA Troop 34, based in the Friedrichshain district, where he was then living. In October 1929, he decided to devote himself full-time to the Nazi movement, and he dropped out of his university studies. In addition to his political activities, Wessel had some musical talents. He played the Schaum, which is a kind of oboe popular in Germany, and he founded an SA Schaum band, which was used to provide music during SA parades and meetings and to attract new followers. In early 1929, Wessel wrote the lyrics for a new Nazi fighting song, or Kampflied, which was published for the first time in Goebbels' newspaper Der Angriff in September of that year, under the title Der unbekannte SA-Mann, which means the unknown SA man. This was the song later known as Die Fahne hoch, from its opening line, or also as the Horst Wessel song. In September of 1929, Wessel met an 18-year-old woman named Erna Janicki. Now, the usual litany of hostile sources have claimed that Erna was a prostitute, but no one has ever produced any actual proof of this allegation. Shortly afterward, he moved in with her at her apartment. This may have contributed to the later slanders against Erna's character, since in those days cohabitation was still considered highly immoral. Now, the landlady was one Frau Salm, whose late husband, unknown to Wessel, had been an active communist. Frau Salm seems to have developed an active dislike for Wessel. Exactly why she would rent to a National Socialist couple living in sin, or why they would rent from a communist-connected landlady, was never clarified, but that appears to have been the situation. Now, on the evening of 14 January 1930, Wessel answered a knock on his door and was shot in the face by an assailant who then fled the scene. He was gravely wounded, and he lingered in hospital until he died on 23 February. His assassin was Albrecht Hüller, an active member of the local Communist Party branch. Now, the KPD denied any knowledge of the attack, but, well, they would, wouldn't they? And said it resulted from a dispute over money between Wessel and his landlady. Later romantic embellishment claimed that Hüller was a former lover of Erna Janicki, and the handsome young stormtrooper had stolen his girl. At this distance in time, it seems impossible to establish the exact details of what happened. A Wessel was buried on the 1st of March in the graveyard of his father's old church. It was reported that 30,000 people lined the streets to see the funeral procession. Goebbels delivered the funeral eulogy in the presence of Hermann Göring and Prince August Wilhelm of Prussia, the son of the former Emperor Wilhelm II, who had joined the SA. When the Nazis came to power in 1933, an elaborate memorial was erected over the grave, and it became the site of annual pilgrimages, which the Horst Wessel song was sung, and speeches were made. With the fall of the Third Reich in 1945, the memorial was destroyed, and Wessel's remains were apparently disinterred and also destroyed. The gravesite has recently been discovered by amateur historians. Horst Wessel's song was banned, along with all other Nazi symbols, in 1945, and both the lyrics and the tune remain illegal in Germany to this day. For many years, I searched the internet for a post-war version of the Horst Wessel song recorded on modern equipment so we wouldn't have to hear it with all that scratchy, hissy, tinny 1930s quality. And finally, one of our people found one. Not only a modern recording, but in English. Although I frankly don't think much of this translation, and I prefer Commander Rockwell's version.
To love.
One of the primary claims of the goat dancers is that I am in some way attempting to do down the reputation or destroy the legacy of the late Dr. William L. Pierce. Now, that is simply not the case. Although I won't go into all this in detail once again, since talking about Pierce, especially the last couple of years of his life before he died, makes so many people uncomfortable. What I will do, once again, in an attempt to demonstrate that no, I am not trying to smear or detract from Pierce's legacy or whatever, is I'm going to play for you one of his better audios. Now, this is Pierce commenting on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I apologize for the rather incongruous musical background, which was added later on by one of Pierce's many fans before it was put up on YouTube, and which can be kind of distracting from what he's saying. Now, maybe this is just me, but for all you Piercies out there, my personal recommendation is that when you're doing YouTubes or whatever of Pierce's audio, please don't try to be Steven Spielberg and add in all these musical flourishes and soundtracks and blah, blah, blah. Just let the man speak. He was brilliant. He doesn't need a musical soundtrack to carry him. Let people hear his words and think about his ideas. Anyway, here we go.
Did you ever wonder why the Jews are such great proponents of democracy? Whether in Indonesia or Pakistan or Serbia or you name it, whenever there is some threat to universal suffrage, the Jews are ready to send the U.S. armed forces in and bomb and kill until everyone is permitted to vote. Why is that? The appeal of mass democracy lies in the fact that in essentially every country in the world today, the number of persons unable to think for themselves is substantially higher than the number able to make independent decisions. Those unable to think for themselves have their thinking done for them by the people who control the mass media. Which is to say, democracy is the preferred system because it gives the political power to those who own or control the mass media, and at the same time allows them to remain behind the scenes and evade responsibility for the way in which they use that power. And the more inclusive the democracy is, that is, the more Alzheimer's sufferers and mongoloid cretins and paranoid schizophrenics and people who live in empty packing cases in alleyways and Jamaican immigrants and football fans are able to vote, the more certain is the grip of the media masters on the political process. Those voters who buy astrology magazines at the checkout stand and spend their time watching soap operas, game shows, and Oprah absorb their general attitudes on things through the television screen. They learn which ideas are fashionable and which are not by noticing the facial expression and tone of voice of Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather when the news is announced each day. Their opinions on specific issues are formed as they view televised sidewalk surveys taken by reporters. The only uncertainty about these people is whether or not they'll be able to pry themselves loose from their couches long enough to vote for the designated candidates. That's why it's important to have lots of them. And wherever there are lots of them, the men who control the mass media also will control the outcome of elections. It's a much surer way of controlling governments than bribing corrupt dictators or slipping seductive whores into the king's bedroom, a la Esther and Ahasuerus, or Monica and Bill. Believe me, one day soon, the Jews on both sides of the Great Water will institute a web TV voting system that allows the couch potatoes and the ball game fans to vote without having to get up from their couches just by clicking their remote controls at their TV screens to select the next president or prime minister. That'll be real democracy. You know, back close to the beginning of this century, around 1901 or so, a book first was published containing the text of what became generally known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. The publisher was a Russian academic, Professor Sergei Nilus. Nilus himself allegedly had obtained the protocols from a Russian official, who had obtained the text from a patriotic Russian noblewoman, who in turn had purchased the material from a Jew in Paris about 15 years earlier. The protocols purports to be a collection of minutes or reports of meetings held by the leaders of the world Jewish community, at which they summarized the progress they had made to that time in their quest for world subversion, world ownership, and world power, and outline their plans for continuing the process in the future. They talk about gaining control of the banking systems of various countries, about fomenting wars and revolutions to weaken and destroy Gentile power, about corrupting music and art and education, about subverting various Gentile institutions, about taking over the press everywhere and controlling the flow of information to the masses, about undermining the family and bringing family values into disrepute, and so on. The Elders of Zion really are a satanic bunch of schemers. Reading the protocols makes one's flesh crawl. We should remember that when the protocols began circulating in Russia in the first decade in this century, that country had not yet fallen victim to Jewish Bolshevism. But that wasn't for lack of trying on the part of the Jews. The Jews were generally recognized as a dangerously subversive element in Russia, as the schemers and string pullers behind every attempt to damage or upset the established order in Russia. So Professor Nilus's publication of the protocols found a ready market among the Russian public. After the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 overthrew the Russian government and established a communist dictatorship in Russia, anyone found with a copy of the protocols was liable to be summarily shot. The text already had been translated into a dozen other languages and distributed far and wide outside Russia, however. Since then, it has been published in virtually every language which has a printed form and has been read by tens of millions of people around the world. The Jews have been claiming hysterically since the protocols first appeared that the text is, quote, a forgery. I guess that's their way of saying that it's not what it purports to be, namely, the actual minutes of meetings of Jewish leaders discussing their plans for world domination. The great American industrialist and automaker Henry Ford was very strongly impressed by the protocols and helped circulate the text in the United States. When told by newspaper reporters in 1921 about the Jews' claims that the protocols was a forgery, Mr. Ford responded that all he could say about the material was that it fit what was actually happening in the world and had been happening ever since the protocols first appeared in print. Of course, what Mr. Ford had especially in mind when he made that remark were two momentous things which had happened during the previous decade. One was the Jews' success in taking over Russia and imposing communism on the Russians. And the other was the recently ended First World War, a horribly fratricidal and senseless war which had destroyed the old order in Europe, had spilled the blood of millions of the best Europeans, and had weakened all of Europe's long-established institutions, leaving every European country open to all manner of social, political, and cultural ills, in particular to the further spread of communism. Well, Henry Ford was a hard-headed, practical sort of man, and it's easy to understand his attitude. He had no way of knowing whether or not the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion was actually what it purported to be. But he was quite impressed by the fact that the plan for world subversion and domination by the Jews outlined in the book seemed to be happening pretty much as described. A 1999 version of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion might read something like this. Greetings, my fellow elders of Zion. Today I am happy to report to you that our plan for the destruction of the hated Gentiles and the acquisition of their remaining wealth is practically complete. There remain only a few loose ends to tie up, and then the struggle in which we have been engaged for thousands of years against the filthy Goyim, against all the non-Jewish peoples of the world, finally will be victorious, and we will be able to devour everything they have created, as Yahweh, the God of our tribe, has commanded us. Everywhere we already rule behind the scenes, with puppets completely under our control in the offices of power. In Russia, where they resisted us for so long, where the ordinary people always hated us as exploiters, as moneylenders and tax collectors, and purveyors of alcohol, and merchants in the sweet white flesh of their daughters and sisters, and where the aristocrats also hated us as subversives and troublemakers, and kept us confined to only certain areas of the country so that we could not exploit all of the people. In Russia, we used the doctrine of our dear departed elder of Zion, Karl Marx, to divide the Russian people against themselves and get the power into our own hands, where it remains to this day. In Russia, we used the doctrine of our dear departed elder of Zion, Karl Marx, to divide the Russian people against themselves and get the power into our own hands, where it remains to this day. We butchered their Tsar and his whole family like the Gentile cattle they were. With the help of the common people, we slaughtered all of the Russian aristocrats and took their wealth. And then we turned on the common people. First, we murdered their leaders, their writers and teachers and intellectuals and military officers, so that there would be no one able to turn the people against us. And then we began murdering the common people themselves, the farmers and workers, first by the millions and then by the tens of millions in labor camps and death camps all across Russia. And most of them never did understand what was happening to them. One of them, who had been studying to become a Christian priest, we corrupted and made into our ally. His name was Stalin. Later, like the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, Stalin tried to turn against us, but one of our women was his doctor, and we poisoned him before he could harm us. When the system based on the theory of our departed elder, Marx, had bled the Russian people dry, we launched a privatization scheme which put most of the remaining wealth directly into our hands. America, however, is the prize example of our success. Just as in England and in Russia, also in America, we have been able to put a totally corrupt Gentile politician into the position of nominal power, and then to surround him with our own people who wield the real power. Actually running the American government, our people are in charge of America's State Department, America's Defense Department, America's Federal Reserve System, and America's Treasury Department. We have gained nearly complete control of America's educational system from kindergarten through the universities. No ideas or facts may be taught unless we have given them the stamp of political correctness. We have made it impossible for anyone in an American university to contradict anything we have claimed, no matter how preposterous, about what happened to us during the Second World War. We now have the American government, just like every government in Europe, paying us reparations because not enough was done for us during the war. We have succeeded in corrupting America's art and music and literature. We have made degeneracy the touchstone for American culture. We own the art galleries and set the standards for painting and sculpture. We have the Americans lining up and paying admission to see a work of art which consists of animal dung smeared onto a crude painting of a negress, which we tell them is their Virgin Mary. They read the depraved and trashy novels we tell them to read and believe that these novels are literature. Their children listen to Negroid rhythms and chant Negroid rap ditties because we control the popular music industry. Through the immigration policy we have imposed on America, we are increasing the percentage of non-white minorities in every part of the country. Within the next few years, we will succeed in making white Americans a minority in their own country. Our success in America has been due to two things: our control of the mass media of news and entertainment, through which we control the ideas and attitudes of the masses, and the system of mass democracy, which ensures that the votes of the masses under our control determine which figurehead politicians actually make up the American government. Since the last part of the 19th century, we have been gathering the power of the mass media into our own hands. In those days, many of us were only rag pickers and dealers in used merchandise, recently off the boat from Russia or Poland. But whenever a Gentile newspaper got itself into financial difficulties, we were ready instantly to pool our resources and buy it out so that henceforth it could be in the hands of one of our people. In the 1920s, when radio was becoming a powerful medium of persuasion, we began buying broadcasting stations and putting together networks. At the same time, we saw the potential for motion pictures and began moving into Hollywood. By working together with each other, we were able to bankrupt or buy out every Gentile film producer except Walt Disney. We had to wait until he died to take control of his film company, but by then we already dominated the entire motion picture industry. After the Second World War, when television became the most powerful medium of mass persuasion, we were ready to move in and dominate the TV industry from the beginning. Today, no motion picture can be made and no television program can be broadcast in America without our approval. The American masses, for the most part, never see or hear anything we have not approved. There is, of course, that pesky internet, which is not yet under our control, but we are moving rapidly to deal with that matter. We expect soon to have our puppet politicians enact hate speech legislation in America, similar to that which we already have in Europe, so that no one can say anything on the internet which has not been approved by us. The couch potatoes will not object, because we will tell them that the new laws will make them safe from terrorism. By that time, we also should have achieved our goal for the disarmament of the American population. And then, my fellow elders of Zion, we can do to the American people what we did to the Russian people. With our power of television, we will have them voting for their own slaughter. Long live our mass media! Long live democracy! Long live the power of triumphant Zion!
That was good. Everything by Dr. Pierce is always good, but I didn't realize it was quite so long. And that musical background, I have to admit, was really distracting. I think we need something good and strong and Aryan to just clear the air here. This is the Edinburgh City Pipe Band.
evening, comrades. Tonight I'm reviewing The Ideology of Tyranny. Now, this is a book that deals with the influence of French authors on American academics, most particularly the influence of Foucault and Vitali, who really influenced Foucault. And this is about how it became very in vogue for certain French authors to promote a Dionysian society. And this was a society where they wanted to break down barriers, and they started to do this by writing about people on the margin of society. Now, this was also an idea about society and the economy that can be diagrammed, and it is diagrammed in this book, about in the Apollonian view of society or side of society, there's this idea of gifts coming from above, and then they are mysteriously replenished through sacrifice. But in the Dionysian society, you have the state and you have power, and sometimes the power of the state conserves wealth and other times it makes wars. But you have, in the Dionysian society, for example, you have the influence of corporation. In the diagram, this makes a large circle, so in a way they're all interconnected, but apparently these French authors were more on the Dionysian side of things, as opposed to another author, Vogel, who was a Victorian and who was more Apollonian, but then he lived in a different time. Really, Vitali was the more creative of the two authors according to this book. These authors influenced both American and European academics to start getting involved with the idea of multiculturalism, which this author believes is very fake. Now, this author tends to see the Islamists as people who are really fighting against globalization. And the author also says that what has happened over time is that the aristocratic elite have been taken over by moneyed elite. Now, this author goes somewhat into the neocons of relatively modern day, talks about how Heidegger, who was also one of these Dionysian authors, as was Ernest Younger, who was a veteran of the First World War and also the Second World War, who was a German author, were also Dionysian writers. And as the author states this, he makes explicit the fact that he does not like the National Socialist movement at all because he feels that they were also Dionysian, even though Vitali did not like the National Socialists. This author also does not like the work of Bloom, who wrote The Closing of the American Mind, even though The Closing of the American Mind was quite a conservative book in that it was very much against all this marginal lexicon in European and American writing and wanted to go back to the classic writers. So you would think this author might in some ways like what Bloom was saying, but the author does not, because the author feels that the book is very disjointed. Now, the advice this author gives is that he believes there should be a return to regional economics, and that is the only thing that is going to defeat this globalism, which the author very much dislikes. In some ways, I wonder how much any intellectuals really influence social policy in some respects, because I know there's always more to it than that. Most people do not base their lives on abstract ideas, but on the other hand, this book does make a compelling case when you look at the world today. Now, I think some of that is just a function of just modern life. I mean, the modern ability, for example, to travel anywhere, but also economic reasons, a very global economy. So, I mean, it's more than just the influence of academics, which in and of itself would probably not be very influential at the end of the day, but if it just stayed in the academic sphere, a sphere of influence. But in a sense, apparently it doesn't. And so this writer is very concerned about this whole idea of the end of history and how that makes a society that I suppose after a while become very static, because it would be a society that you really could not change. Now, this book, it's very sophisticated, and I would have to say it's a lot to absorb, but I know I only have so much time to review a certain book, and I know I want to produce these commentaries fairly frequently, in case Harold needs my assistance for the show. So I hope you enjoyed this book. The author, which I think is maybe a pen name, you can actually find a couple of books by this author online, and he has another book about the history of World War II. I would have to say this is a very academic author, and an author that does not particularly agree with us per se, but if you like this very academic type of treatise, then I suppose this is a book that you would enjoy. So it's a book that you'd probably want to look up. The author's name, as I say, could potentially be a pen name, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, but the last name seems to be Preparta. I hope you've enjoyed this review, and thank you for listening.
Okay, now we come to the part I understand a lot of our community has come to wait for. The housekeeping internal NF part, where everybody tunes in hoping to hear some gossip. Now, since I've started discussing organizational matters on here, there's been a spike in the number of hits on the website. I'm sure if I wanted to get NorthwestFront.org's hit numbers up, I could do it by turning this show into a kind of a racist version of TMZ.com. As I said, I'm in the process of segueing out of my primary role as a writer and propagandist and into my new role as principal of Movement Junior High, and it's now necessary for me to talk about some things that I know some of you don't think should be discussed in public, and you're right about some of those things. But I repeat that in these early days of the NF's development, I'm going to assume that once you filter out the FBI and the SPLC monitors and naval intelligence and whatnot, all or at least most of you guys listening to this are future white leaders, or at least potential leaders. So in view of my own unlikely survival to the point where I can see the finish line, there is a very good chance that you are going to have to do this kind of thing yourselves and act as the principal of your own Movement Junior Highs. So you need to pay attention here while I teach you some tricks of the trade. Okay, last week I mentioned that from now on new people who are interested in getting active with the Northwest Front are going to have to give us some information, which will be used in vetting them and performing a background check just as if they had applied for a job at Walmart. Now, part of the information we'll be asking for will be Social Security number and date of birth, which are the two keystone items for background checking, and this vetting procedure will include a criminal and military records check. This does not mean that anyone who drops us an email expressing interest in the party will be immediately confronted with a long paper form demanding all kinds of personal details. This is for people resident in the homeland who want to become active with a local cell or crew or team or whatever you want to call them. In other words, people who want to get close enough to where they could do some damage if it turns out that they're not as advertised. This does not mean that you cannot support the Northwest Front or pass out literature or otherwise assist us if you don't want to give us this information. That's up to you. This new requirement is for people who wish to be assigned to a unit or a community here in the Northwest homeland itself and who wish to work on a regular personal physical basis with other comrades. In other words, basically meet people. I will repeat, this is for those who want to get close enough to do some damage if they're not what they should be. Now, after last week, I did catch some flack for this, but not as much goat dancing as I expected. The flack consisted almost entirely of anonymous abuse in the comments section from people who were clearly mentally or emotionally disturbed. In other words, the opposition to this idea comes largely from the very kind of people who couldn't pass a background check themselves and who are clearly upset about it. I repeat, that longtime NF people and associates of mine who have proven themselves by sticking with it for years, not just with me, but with white nationalism in general, will be grandfathered in. Now, that's what impresses me about someone more than anything else. Not so much intelligence or ability or talent or street smarts, because we've always been able to attract that on a short-term basis. But those people have a tendency to be intensely interested for 15 minutes and then wander away when they see that there's no outward visible signs of money and no quote-unquote action for adrenaline junkies around, since Americans are socially engineered to respond only to money and personal self-gratification. The party, by necessity, has to appeal to idealism and self-sacrifice, and American white people don't do idealism and self-sacrifice anymore. Haven't done for a long time. So what I look for and what I'm impressed with more than just about anything else is track record, time and grade, and unfortunately the only thing that will help someone build up time and grade is, well, time. Okay, tell you what, let's call it persistence. Dogged persistence, that's what I'm looking for. I'll read you a quote here from the last decent and honorable president the United States ever had, Calvin Coolidge. "Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, press on, has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race." Now that's the attitude I'm looking for in Northwest Front comrades, probably more than anything else. The ability to make a moral decision and then stay the course for a whole lifetime if need be. But here's where we move way out of the comfort zone. The fact is that among many other problems caused by the character issue, one of the reasons that our movement can't keep good people is because they come in and they find that they are expected to work and associate and place their welfare and quite possibly their futures and their lives into the hands of people who are clearly not suited for that responsibility. The brutal fact, which even most of us shy away from mentioning because it sounds so snobbish and elitist and arrogant, is that the bad always drives out the good, and we need quality control of personnel not just to keep the dysfunctionals and the Looney Tunes out, but to keep the good people in. Now, I am not going to go off on one of my character issue tirades here, nor am I going to discuss Gubu and goat dancing as a whole. For those of you who came in late, I devoted the Radio Free Northwest episode of February the 21st, 2013, to the goat dance. And I would like for that episode to stand as my official response, my canned answer, to all Gubu and character-related issues. Now that's Radio Free Northwest for February 21st, 2013, for all you gossip mongers out there. But I will say this, and judging from the comparatively muted response I got to last week's show, which I repeat was a lot less shrill and hysterical than I frankly expected, I think pretty much everybody in this wee little subculture of ours who has two brain cells to rub together has, after far too many years, finally figured out that, go dancing bullshit aside, white nationalism of all tendencies has got to start making some kind of serious effort to pre-screen the people whom we allow to get close to the centers of operation, whom we allow to act as public spokesmen, and who are allowed personal contact in real time with real people, because that's where the danger lies. For those of you who don't agree with this, I got two words for you. Craig Cobb. Now, the internet doesn't really matter. The internet isn't real. The internet is where sick and damaged people go to vomit, to wrestle with their demons in public. Now, this is why I'm always amazed that these loons think that they are somehow bothering me by posting anonymous abuse on the internet or death threats on my blogs or whatever. For the past 45 years, since I started racial scribbling at Chapel Hill High School, I have always signed everything I wrote. Why on earth would I be afraid of someone who won't even let me know who he is, so I'll know just what it is I'm supposed to be afraid of? But the internet can tell us a lot about someone's suitability and ability to work in the real world in real time with real people. And with the addition of that social security number and date of birth, it can not only make it possible for the party to function, but possibly even save some lives. Now, I'm thinking of two examples from my own past. The far past, from back in the 80s, before we had the internet, where if I had had access to a full and complete background check on an individual before allowing him to get close, quite literally, lives would have been saved. Now, I won't get into details, since there are already kookazoids out there who are sufficiently obsessed with the 80s and 90s. One was a man who was later shown to be acting on a hidden agenda, and the other may have been, or he may have been just plain nuts, I don't know. But take it from me, infinite pain and suffering would have been avoided had I had any way of evaluating these men beforehand other than what they presented for the rest of the world to see. And anyone who has had any extensive experience at all in white nationalism will be able to tell you his own stories along that line. Now, I have been ranting and raving about this character issue for decades. It's time that we did something about it, and that starts now. Those who seek personal participation in the Northwest Front will, from this point on, be required to provide certain basic information so that they can be checked out. And for the first time in the movement's history, someone will be demanding the same information from prospective revolutionaries that Dairy Queen asks for on a job application, and the same information that any police or federal agency already knows and can bring up on their computers about someone within 30 seconds. This is historic. So far as I know, no white nationalist group over the past 60 years has ever dared even to ask for this much, and we have paid the price for it. In light of the subject we've been talking about for the past few minutes, you can take this song however you will. This is the Kingston Trio.
It's a fact that your head is cracked.
Got damn bien somos locos.
Well, I know it's true, you are cuckoo too.
Got damn bien somos locos.
Once again I said, you have lost your head.
Got damn bien somos locos.
Since your ego's curved, you are too disturbed.
Got damn bien somos locos.
Chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica, chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica, chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica, chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica, chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica, chico chico, chico chica, chico 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 chica.
You are paranoid and your head's a void.
Ya también somos locos.
Since your wig is flipped, your skull's come unzipped.
Ya también somos locos.
Okay, last week I was chatting with one of our people, and he mentioned the fact that the Eric Holder Justice Department, you know, the same one that openly refuses to investigate civil rights violations committed by blacks against whites, had indicted that anti-Obama movie-making wog Dinesh D'Souza and former Republican Governor McDonnell of Virginia, plus there's all the direct they're piling on Chris Christie in New Jersey. So it's apparent that in the run-up to the 2014 elections, the Democrats are clearing the way by criminalizing political differences. I imagine they especially want to get Dinesh D'Souza out from behind that director's camera. Plus, they're going after Chris Christie because he's the only Republican in the polls who looks like he might be able to give Hillary some agita in 2016. Now, this, in turn, led to the topic of GOP entryism on the part of the Northwest Front, something that's discussed briefly in the 5th edition white book that I sent out this morning in PDF format. And that, in turn, led to some back and forths, which I think I should summarize for the benefit of everybody listening, because we keep wondering how things are going to turn our way. And people keep asking me to peer into my crystal ball and give them specific dates. And this is as close as I can get. I think it's a fairly safe prediction as to how things are going to be going politically in the medium term, by which I mean, say, until after the midterm elections. All of this, by the way, will be based on the common assumption, an incorrect one, that the votes are counted honestly in American elections. Now, they won't be. Barry won the presidency in 2008 through fraud in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and in 2012 through fraud all over due to illegal aliens voting. But I know the concept that these whole things are nothing but pointless dog and pony shows with predetermined outcomes is too big and too heavy for Americans to wrap their minds around. They kind of shut down when they try to contemplate it. If ever they really got it, that the whole thing is fake, kind of like professional wrestling, then I think what passes for the American mind would implode, so we won't get into that now. Just suffice to say that the best way to understand the political reality in this country is that Republicans steal money, Democrats steal elections. This election year may well be the most turbulent, bitter, angry, and generally rambunctious in history. I doubt any blood will be spilled this time, since white people are too weak and soft and timid and frightened to do so anymore. Although there may be some electoral violence directed against Republicans and the Tea Party with white people as victims, which seems to be our role in this society these days, perpetual victims. Now, this year's going to be bad, I think. Not so much 2016, because I think by then the Republicans will be in such a shambles that Hillary will basically just get the presidency more or less by acclamation, and she'll just go cakewalking right into the White House. I think the real blood in the water is going to happen this year, since some of the stupid Republicans don't seem to have internalized yet that the Democrats have now created a permanent welfare underclass of blacks and browns and newly amnestied illegal aliens, along with newly pauperized whites. This underclass is dependent on either government employment or some kind of government subsidies to survive on, for which the Democrats buy their votes. Kind of like the old patronage system used to work under Mayor Daley in Chicago. And I think it's no coincidence that Obama and his first team, including Rahm Emanuel, came from Chicago. Normal white people with real jobs and not government checks of various kinds are now outnumbered at the polls. And from this point on, the Republican vote is going to be less and less each election as white people die off and the GOP just withers away, and we head into the long night of Democrat one-party rule for the rest of this country's existence, which will be roughly one more generation, maybe, before various people finally get tired of America's horseshit and they start reaching for those 300 million firearms that are in private hands in this country. Now, the rhinos or country club Republicans seem to be obsessed with this really weird idea that somehow they're going to persuade Mexicans and niggers to vote for them. Now, that's not going to happen, and I am astounded that so many otherwise intelligent politicians think it might, but I guess that one should never underestimate mankind's infinite capacity for self-delusion. The niggers and the beaners know what the score is. They're third-worlders. They do this at home. They march to the polls every election, and they vote Democrat, and the Democrats keep the goodies flowing to the dinges and the spicks. The only way that the Republicans could ever change that is to out-bribe the Democrats, and that they can't do because, for one thing, they're never again going to get their hands on the taxpayer boodle, although a few of them, like McCain and Lindsey Graham, seem inclined to try. They won't be able to pull it off, though. What will happen is that after the defeat of the Republicans in 2014, and most likely their loss of the House, what will happen is that with a Democrat majority in Congress, pure dictatorship will set in, and the GOP will be effectively done. I repeat, they will not even be able to swing any kind of serious effort against Hillary in 2016. Now, the RINOs, or the Country Club Republicans, or Rockefeller Republicans, whatever you want to call the 1%, will blame the Tea Party and so-called conservatism for their defeat, which won't be true. Their defeat will be due to racial demographics and the fact that the Democrat Party is completely corrupt from top to bottom and has no ethics of any kind and literally doesn't mind just plain bribing their way into perpetual power. Now, the Republicans will go through a mass purge, and somehow, most likely by changing or simply ignoring the law, they will purge the so-called Tea Party elements from their own party, or at least from their ballots. The Tea Partiers will then form their own third party, like George Wallace did in 1968 and Ross Perot did in 1992, thus irrevocably splitting the white vote. And along with demographics and economics, they will ensure that generation of one-party Democrat rule I mentioned just now, however short that generation may turn out to be. Yes, 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 I know the Republicans are just as bad in their own way as the Democrats, and I would cut out my own tongue rather than imply differently. I have not forgotten 8 years of Jugear's Bush. But your average low-information voter, as Rush Limbaugh calls him, which is a polite term for white dumbass, actually believes the Democrat media when they call Republicans racist and sexist and homophobic and too white and too male and so forth, and a lot of them will probably vote Republican just for that. So whether we like it or not, we are now presented with a so-called white opposition, gift-wrapped by the media. Yes, of course it's all bogus. I know that. I get it. Of course the Republicans are complete cowardly stumblebums who will then spend all their time screaming in denial that they are not racist and homophobic and blah, 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 blah. But the fact is, this is a political dynamic that exists. The Democrats have created it for a reason, and although they didn't intend to do it for our purposes, it's there and it's ready-made for us. It has the kosher seal of approval, and it is not blacked out. Republican bashing is one of the few areas wherein the media will allow even a slight discussion of race in their controlled forums and on the airwaves. Now, why should we not find various ways of taking advantage of this? Why should we not slide into this Republican-Democrat thingummy and do a little hijacking, so to speak? Tell you what, let me hear from you guys on that next week. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.